from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. The mind-boggling moments along the presidential campaign trail keep coming at a pace that seems almost unsustainable. Each one seems like it could be a defining moment until the next bend in the roller coaster, the next stunning quote or startling statement bends the story in yet another new direction. And so in this half-hour forum, we're going to get some in-the-moment perspective from a political reporter covering this unfolding drama. And then a little bit later, Face the Nation's John Dickerson will join us. His new book, Whistle Stop, also serves to remind us that as amazingly new as campaign 2016 seems to be, there are actually some echoes in it from our past. But joining us first is Michael Memoli, who's covering the campaign for the Los Angeles Times. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I've been paying pretty close attention, but I haven't listened to the news for the last 25 minutes. Anything going on?
I haven't had a chance to check my Twitter feed either to see what's the latest. I thought you captured it pretty incredibly well in terms of what we've seen over the course of this campaign. Yesterday was an incredible example of that. We thought the story in the morning would be what the president had to say about Donald Trump, pretty explicit in terms of his view of his capacity to serve in his office. But by the end of the day, I was rewriting my story a third time to incorporate what Donald Trump had said in an interview with the Washington Post about some of the other Republican leaders in the party and whether or not he would support them. So surely we're all on our toes here at all times because the pace of news is coming so quickly.
You feel these things as being, well, is this sort of a defining moment when you see the president say, this person is unfit to serve? I can't in my lifetime remember a sitting president saying that about a presidential candidate. The president was careful to say he certainly did not feel that way about either Mitt Romney or John McCain. I don't remember a presidential candidate saying the Speaker of the House, the Speaker of his own party, was someone he would not endorse, or a former presidential candidate of his own party is someone he would not endorse. Does it strike you as being sort of unique within your reporting experience, Michael?
Absolutely. I mean, I cover the White House as well as the campaign for the LA Times, and I was in the East Room for that news conference yesterday. And to hear the president so coolly and with, you know, lawyer-like precision lay out what his arguments were about Trump and also the party was really striking, given what we've seen him say over the course of the year. I remember a news conference he did at the Sunnylands grounds in Southern California there after a summit with East Asian leaders. And, of course, this was much earlier in the process, and Trump was really facing his first electoral test. He had been leading in a lot of the polls, and the first primaries were about to begin. And the president was asked about the prospect of Trump, you know, winning the White House. And the president sort of dismissed it and said, you know, I have confidence in the American people that this is more than a reality show, and they'll make the right decision in the end. But we've seen him sort of evolve over the course of the year and to become more direct and more blunt about his concerns. And what was, I think, the most striking thing about yesterday was this was not his speech to a Democratic convention. This was not a campaign rally with Secretary Clinton. This was in the East Room of the White House with a foreign head of government who he was welcoming for a state dinner. And to say what he said was more than just about Trump. I mean, we all know that the president has motivations here, starting with the fact that, you know, he genuinely thinks Hillary Clinton should be elected. He's a loyal Democrat, and he's talked about how qualified he views her to be, uniquely qualified in American history. He needs a Democrat to win in many ways to preserve his legacy, and so we all understand the motivations there. He wants somebody who would not sign legislation repealing any number of his signature achievements. But I think what we saw yesterday was a reflection of what has been much more concerning to the president lately. He's obviously very clear about what he thinks about Trump and his qualifications, but he's looking at the political environment right now and is very concerned about the ways in which Donald Trump is sort of manipulating people's fears and cynicism in a way to win the White House. This is, of course, a candidate who ran on the idea of hope and change, and has, you know, I think despite some difficult moments, tried to appeal to people's better aspirations. And that's what the message yesterday was really about, was less about Trump and more about the other Republicans How much longer can they sort of stand by and watch him say these things, simply denounce them and try to distance themselves from them before they tacitly endorse them by continuing to endorse him? And so that was his message really yesterday, was directed at those not only Republican elected officials who might understandably not want to take his advice, but particularly Republican voters, Republican-leaning voters who might not be big fans of the president or support Hillary Clinton or have confidence in Hillary Clinton just yet. But it's an appeal to sort of the better angels of our government and what we believe to be true about the United States. As he said himself, I had problems with John McCain and Mitt Romney on policy. We certainly disagreed on the right approach for the country, but I never thought that they couldn't do the job.
And just one last thing, Michael, and this is, of course, impossible to know. It seems unimaginable that the Speaker of the House would now disavow or take back his endorsement of the nominee of his own party. And yet, of course, this campaign has been full of things that we once thought were not imaginable. Does it seem possible to you? Do you have any sense from your own sources that that is something that is even being contemplated?
I should say I spoke with Congressman Ryan's office, Speaker Ryan's office yesterday, as well as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office, to get their reactions. And they were saying little publicly, at least, about what they thought about what the president's advice to them was. But I think later in the day, Donald Trump's comments himself in some ways may have opened a door for Paul Ryan to make a cleaner break from Donald Trump than he might have otherwise. When he did endorse him, it was very obviously reluctantly. And he's actually joked in public about sort of how reluctantly his support to Donald Trump has come. When Donald Trump says in an interview that he's not sure if he can support Paul Ryan, who does have a Republican primary challenge in Wisconsin next week in his congressional district, I think that potentially could give Speaker Ryan the platform after he wins, which by all counts he's well ahead and should win next Tuesday, to maybe say, you know what, he didn't support me, and the voters in my district who know me best, and not only that, but the members of my caucus who I am the leader of still support me, and I think this has come to a point where we need to go in a different direction. Wow. And if he did so, I think there would be dozens of elected officials who would follow him in the party. And whether or not that would have an impact on Trump, whether he would take that and exit the race or simply retaliate even further is an open question. And I think that's what Paul Ryan's overarching concern is what would the impact be for electing Republicans across the country? What's in the best interest for him to stay Speaker and for them to stay in the majority?
Michael Memoli, political reporter covering this extraordinary race for the Los Angeles Times. Michael, thanks so much for joining us on Forum today.
Happy to do it.
Joining us now is John Dickerson, the host of CBS's Face the Nation, also political director for CBS, has covered six presidential races. He's also the author of a new book, Whistle Stop, which looks at some of the most memorable moments in presidential campaigns past. John, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on our program. Want to very interested in getting your take on giving us some historical perspective on presidential campaigns, because we live in sort of this ahistorical time, I think, and I think it'll be refreshing and helpful to get a sense of some of the echoes this current campaign has from times past. But I must begin by getting your sense of this extraordinary moment that we are in. I just got handed a note about titled "Trump Asks Why U.S. Can't Use Nukes" from MSNBC. So these moments keep coming, and I'm just curious of your as to your sense of that, the way in which these come one after the other after the other after the other.
Well, again, it's it seems out of control, and they now, by the way, the Trump campaign, Paul Manafort, is denying that he said this. But when Trump may or may not have said, but what he definitely has said in conversation is, why, if we've got nuclear weapons, can't we use them? In other words, if we don't have the threat real that we might someday use nuclear weapons, what's the point of having them? This echoes a conversation that Curtis LeMay, who was the running mate for George Wallace, the independent candidate in the 1968 race, Curtis LeMay had a famous press conference in which he was announced as Wallace's running mate. And basically in a conversation actually with Jack Nelson of the LA Times, asked him about nuclear weapons. And he essentially said a version of this. And it became such a problem that the ticket came to be known as the Bomsey twins because they seemed a little too interested in metallic solutions to nettlesome foreign policy problems. But it's a way in which this echo, we've heard this before, this idea of if we have nuclear weapons, why can't we at least, you know, use them, because the threat's got to be real.
Well, let's take then some of the way in which some of these moments, these extraordinary moments from our current campaign, because they certainly are that, even if they are not unique, they are seemingly extraordinary, do reflect back. You mentioned the echoes back to the Wallace campaign of 1968. And I'm also struck by some of the similarities that you reference in your book to the time of 1964 and the Barry Goldwater campaign. You write about the moment when Nelson Rockefeller tried to address the convention here in San Francisco at the Cow Palace and was shouted down by the Goldwater supporters, not unlike the moment that Ted Cruz experienced in Cleveland a few weeks back when he was shouted down by Trump supporters in Cleveland. But the one that really struck me, John Dickerson, was you referenced this moment that became, I guess, a commercial from the Johnson campaign, where either an actor or someone who was indeed a Republican reflected back on what had happened at the convention in 64. And I just want to read a little bit from this in your book, where this person this became a commercial in the Johnson campaign, someone who was either a Republican or an actor playing a Republican, says, I've always been a Republican. I voted for Eisenhower. But Goldwater, now it seems to me we're up against a very different, difficult kind of man. This man scares me. A reporter will go to Senator Goldwater and he'll say, Senator, on such and such a day you said, and I quote, blah, 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 whatever it is, end quote. And then Goldwater says, well, I wouldn't put it that way. I can't follow that. Well, was he serious? Did he put it that way? Is he serious? And he just goes on and on and on. And then at the end, he says, you know, I'm just not sure if I can really vote for him. I can't do that. And then the commercial ends with saying, you know, we have too much at stake. Vote for Lyndon Johnson. You can imagine an exact version of that being done on behalf of Hillary Clinton for Donald Trump. I mean, well, we do have these echoes.
You don't even have to imagine it. They have done it. They have found the same actor, and he does a version of this.
Oh, my goodness.
And has done a version of this for the Clinton campaign. And the idea essentially was not only and the reason that Rockefeller was booed is because he basically said extremists had taken over the party, were too much of an influence in the party. And he was booed because that was essentially the argument that the left was making. But that's what in this Johnson commercial was made. That was the argument of the commercial as well, which is that extremists had taken over the party and you see what Johnson was trying to do, which is essentially drive a wedge between the Goldwater conservatives and the Republicans, the moderate Republicans. There were such things in 1964,
yeah,
a lot of them actually. And Johnson was trying to grab them in the same way that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, what Barack Obama is doing when he in his convention speech says that Donald Trump is neither a Republican nor a conservative, he's making mischief in the other party in the same way Johnson was. He's trying to say to Republicans, I know you don't agree with this person. Come over to the Democratic Party. We won't vilify you because you're Republicans. We recognize that this person is a danger, and that's something that we can share. And based on that, we can perhaps come to some common understanding about the way we should go forward as a country.
John Dickerson joins us, the host, of course, of CBS's Face the Nation and the author of a new book called Whistle Stop, in which he brings together stories from campaigns past and reminds us that however extraordinary our current campaign seems, there have been so many extraordinary campaigns in America's past. If you have a question for John and would like to join us, you can call us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. What lessons do you draw, John, from these echoes, these parallels, whether it be from the Wallace campaign of 68, the Goldwater campaign of 64, that we should sort of get some perspective from, because we tend to think that everything we're experiencing now is so unique, so incredible, so unprecedented. What kind of perspective can you help us with that gives us some sort of greater sense of what we're experiencing now?
Well, I guess two things come to mind. One is politics has always been messy, and we used to tolerate the messiness a lot more than we do now. And my view is that the messiness of politics, if we tolerate it, that's how you figure out what you really believe. It's how people make their case, get engaged sometimes in arguments that get heated, but they adjudicate things and they come to a view about ideas and what they stand for. And now, and that's why conventions used to be quite contentious and lots of twists and turns. Now, if there's the tiniest little peep, it's on cable news all day long, and there's this gnashing of teeth, and the party's falling apart. And parties are supposed to be kind of messy affairs. And if we tolerated that, I think a little bit more, we would ideas wouldn't get subsumed for so long that they then had to burst through in an act of quasi-violence. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is that we've always had these tensions in American politics between the voice of the people and the voice of the elites. If you look at the election of 1824, Andrew Jackson, it's a multi-candidate field. It ends up going into the House of Representatives. Andrew Jackson loses to John Quincy Adams, but in his loss builds the case for his 1828 victory. But in that race in 1824, there's a battle between whether to pick the nominee of the party through a caucus, essentially a caucus of the members of the party in the House of Representatives, or to use state conventions and even sort of quasi-primaries. And Jackson says, if I ever fill that office, meaning the presidency, it must be the free choice of the people. So that's the Bernie Sanders pitch. You know, no superdelegates. It's got to be the people's choice. That's certainly the case that Donald Trump made in his candidacy. In other words, when there was a period where he might not get the 1,237 delegates he needed to win, he was basically saying, look, more people have voted for me and the people should rule. Others say, sure, the people should have a voice, but there should be some mechanism to stay the passions of the people, because people can get dazzled. And again, in 1824, they were worried that people would be dazzled by Jackson's military glory. It was much more of a liability to be a military leader in 1824 than it would be today. It was seen as certainly a set of skills, but ones that were maybe antithetical to the office of the presidency, and certainly one that occluded any political skill that you really needed. The political skill was something that they looked for in candidates. We don't look for that anymore. But a lot of these fights have been going on for the entire course of American history. And so if we're engaged in them again, it's not a crisis. It's just the natural conflict we have, and so let's go figure out what the answer is, but don't cover it like it's a plane crash.
Yeah. I want to ask you also, John, if you would, to get your sense of to connect some dots. I want to string together a series of past candidate names and see if you can help us understand perhaps the way in which they do connect. We've talked about a little bit about George Wallace and Barry Goldwater. It seems to me also that in some ways Donald Trump taps into something that other candidates have in the past. Perhaps Wallace did. In some ways, I think also Pat Buchanan did. And these are unlike names, but so did John Kennedy, perhaps, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, even Gene McCarthy. They're all people who tapped into some sort of strain in American politics. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I particularly am. I like the reference to Buchanan because it's one that I've been making. I don't write about this specifically in the book, but you know, when people say, "Well, the press didn't understand that there was anger in the country, and that's why they missed the Trump phenomenon," that's not right. It doesn't seem any of us who covered Buchanan in '92 and '96, as I did. You saw the anger. You knew the Buchanan voter is very similar, in my mind, to the Trump voter. We saw in the Tea Party a revolt against Washington solutions that sounds very much like Wallace. When Wallace is talking about busing and housing policies coming from Washington, these top-down solutions, these top-down policies that are clamped onto people's lives and force them to go into all kinds of, you know, force them to basically live their lives differently than they would like to. That was the one of the keys of the Wallace campaign. Obviously, there's the law and order echo from Wallace in 68 and what we hear from Donald Trump. Goldwater also, which was, you know, Goldwater coming from the West, part of the reason he was able to rise is they were the Republicans were able to undermine the control of Eastern North, so basically Eastern moderate Republicans. Goldwater, there was a much more of a kind of passion for liberty in the West that Goldwater represented. And that we hear now in all kinds of Republican candidates, not so much Donald Trump, but the traditional Republican canon has a large passage on freedom being at the center of all candidacies. All efforts must be to unleash and protect freedom. And that you hear that in coming out of Goldwater. So a lot of those names are connected. And McCarthy, I feel like McCarthy connects to a sort of McCarthy, McGovern, Jerry Brown, Howard Dean, Bernie Sanders. I feel like there's a line in Democratic history that goes connects all of those candidates.
John Dickerson joined us. His new book is Whistle Stop, and some people would like to pose a few questions for you. John, David joins us first. David, go ahead with your question for John Dickerson.
Well, one sounds like a frivolous one, but it's actually kind of serious. You're probably familiar with the movie The Producers. It gets to my mind whether or not Donald Trump has actually got bad books, and he was trying to cover up his bad books, and he's trying to pull a Producers. He's trying to lose, and every time he says something stupid, they won't let him lose. And whether or not you think he's actually doing that. The other question has to do with his campaign manager, Paul Manafort. Manafort has been a PR agent basically for some say as few as six different dictators, but there are a number of people who have attempted coups around the world, and Paul Manafort was the manager of him or of them. So can you tell us about Paul Manafort's history and his how does a guy like Paul Manafort get a business license to run dictatorships?
I don't think there's a licensing office for that. I think it's part of the unrestrained and unrestricted commerce that he's been able to have those relationships in the United States for certain countries that that he's worked for that have leaders that have often been on the opposite side of American foreign policy. He was a lobbyist as well. And there is some obvious disconnect between Donald Trump's candidacy, which is very much anti-lobbyist, anti-insider, anti-special interest, and that Paul Manafort was one. When I've asked him about that, he said, well, I was one a long time ago. I'm not doing any of that anymore. So that's his response to that question. On the question of whether Donald Trump is trying to throw his campaign, he is such a passion for winning and doing things his way that I think this is more just him doing it his way, and he thinks it's going to win. I don't know. This idea has been around for some number of months that he's maybe not as serious as he would seem, but everybody that works close to him and that with whom he interacts suggests that in private moments he shows a passion for winning, which is to say, he's not happy when he's not winning. That you wouldn't maybe have if this were all sort of a lark or a stratagem. He seems pretty committed to it based on the reporting I've done.
John, I want to ask you what I asked Michael Memoli about. This seems so unlikely that the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, or Mitch McConnell, the leader in the Senate, would renounce the nominee of their own party. Michael seemed to suggest that, you know, that's not actually beyond a possibility. What's your take on that?
Well, my take is they are in a box, and I'm not sure how they get out of it. You know, so, you know, Barack Obama has now said you should repudiate or break from this candidate. Well, that's put them in more of a box because Republicans don't want their leaders to go do what this president they disapprove of asked them to do. So that's one problem. The other problem is that there are if they want to get elected in future races, particularly those who have their eye on 2020, and that's certainly Paul Ryan would be in that category, you can't offend the portion of the Trump vote that would think you were being basically helping Hillary Clinton get elected. And so you're going to need those voters in future races. On the other hand, you end up getting tattooed by a candidate who does things that you have called racist. I mean, Paul Ryan has said that Donald yeah. Trump's claims are racist. So on the one hand, you're stuck to a candidate you've said is racist. And on the other hand, you can't break from him because you need the voters who like him so much. And even if they don't like Donald Trump, I've been really struck by this. The number of people who would think it an act of apostasy to break from a party nominee. I mean, when Jeb Bush said, I won't keep the pledge and support Donald Trump, the pledge they all signed as candidates in the primary. Here was a man, Donald Trump, who insulted Jeb Bush's wife, said that his brother, George W. Bush, launched a war based on a lie and should be impeached, and said all kinds of things about Jeb Bush himself. That should be grounds maybe to break a pledge, just in terms of just pure insult. And yet many Republicans I talked to felt like Jeb Bush had really broken his word and done something unconscionable in not supporting Donald Trump. That feeling is something, if you've got aspirations for 2020, you don't want to get in touch with.
John, just briefly, so much of your book are about these iconic moments in American politics and presidential campaigns. Do you think we've seen that moment yet? You're tempted to think when Mr. Khan held out his copy of the Constitution that might be such a moment. Do you think we've seen that moment, or is that moment still to come?
I think it is a real contender for a turning point moment. And the question always is it a moment that actually turns events? Does a Republican lawmaker think differently? Does the race actually change? Or was the race bending and this happened at a signature moment? So it becomes a signifier rather than something that changes pace. And we don't know, but it's definitely in contention.
We'll have to leave it there. John Dickerson, thanks so much for being with us. John, by the way, will appear at the Brava Theater in San Francisco on August the 10th at 7:30. You can learn more about that at slate.com/live. John, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Forum on KQED. Stay with us for our next hour of Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.